Episode 30.
And sport is just circus. We might as well just take all the broken athletes and just throw their bodies to the lions when they retire. And just, so you're going to ultimately make a pact with the devil. You're like, I'm going to do this, and maybe I'll make some money, and maybe I'll be able to spin this into something, and maybe I'll have this extraordinary life, but I won't have knees, and I'll have three herniated discs, and it will have been worth it for the next 70 years of crippled pain, right?
You might be smarter, your daddy might own a company, but you will not outwork me.
This one right here is for the people.
I'm your host, Ryan J. Owens, current pro athlete, entrepreneur, and former USA national team volleyball player. I will not be defined by my athleticism alone, but I've learned how to leverage it to stay passionate about it and prepare for life. That's why the Beyond Athletic podcast was born. I'll bring you case studies of current and former elite athletes making it happen in life, as well as tips and lessons from top sources in sports, nutrition, fitness, entrepreneurship, and more. I'm here to tell you that you are beyond athletic. Hello, Beyond Athletic listeners. Today is a fantastic episode. We got on Dr. Kelly Starrett. I'm going to just tell you a little bit about him really quick because we jumped right into things in this episode and it was just so good. I couldn't even backtrack to talk more about his bio, but he is a former U.S. canoe team member, co-owner of San Francisco CrossFit and Mobility WOD, which is an extremely amazing resource for learning how to fix old injuries and prevent new injuries by little videos that some are free, some are paid. There's tons of content, trust me. He's a New York Times and Wall Street Journal best-selling author, including Becoming a Supple Leopard, The Ultimate Guide to Resolving Pain, Preventing Injury, and Optimizing Athletic Performance. And his new book, Ready to Run, Unlocking Your Potential to Run Naturally, where he talks about how most people, even a lot of elite athletes, are heel striking and running incorrectly and creating so many more issues when all they want to do is either compete at a high level because they enjoy it, or just do it day to day because it keeps you healthy. So he trains top athletes in CrossFit as well as Olympians around the world. He's an official trainer for Reebok One and an instructor on creativelive.com's educational website. So go check him out there. I deem him the hip hero or ankle angel because I mean, just so much that I found from him online has helped me throughout my career. So we get into a ton of stuff about standing desks, learning to read leading indicators, which sports are good, ball sports, sliding sports, which basic things that athletes need to have and just anyone in general should be able to do on a day-to-day basis when you talk about fitness level and staying healthy. You'll learn in here why he says the first wealth is health, and I hope you enjoy it. Dr. Kelly Starrett. What's up, everybody? Ryan J. Owens here. Today's a game plan session where we give athletes knowledge to optimize their lives. Today's featured guest is Dr. Kelly Starrett. Kelly, you ready to game plan?
Game on.
Well, I'm going to give people a little bit of background, especially why I wanted to have you on, but I'm going to take it back to 2009. I was in Italy. I was riding my little Italian bike to cafes, having my little macchiatos and my gelato. And I was sitting down all the time. And this was just after a season where I was doing a lot of Olympic lifts. And at the end of that summer of just sitting and drinking cafe and gelato, man, I had, for the first time in my life, knee problems. I've always been like, you know, I can jump and I can run and it doesn't even matter. Like if I'm standing and I just woke up, like let's say I woke up out of bed, I could dunk a ball and it's like, whatever, who cares? But at this point, like I'm walking up and down stairs or I'm just getting out of a chair and my knee would just give out. And I was freaked out. Like I called up my sister, who's a trainer for the U.S. women's soccer team. And I go, Jules, my knee, there's got to be something wrong. We did MRI, everything. She's like, Ryan, you're fine. Like you just need to stretch and get your hips right and your butt is weak and all this stuff. And this is the first time I ever heard about it. And I was trying to do something about it a couple of years back and I ran across you. And I was like, what is this mobility stuff? And I was like, is it something like we're doing with Team USA? Like, what is this? So I'm just really excited to have you on. And I hope we're going to give, and I know we're going to give people a ton of stuff. But I want to give your bio really quick. You're a husband to an elite athlete and a businesswoman, Juliet Starrett, and you have two kids. Your older plays volleyball, which is rad, and this was one of the first things we were talking about. But my question to you is, like, what are these kids going to be doing when they're older? They're not only going to be, like, the most mobile humans in the world, but they're going to be so athletic.
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point about especially around youth sports. And, you know, one of the fundamental ideas that Juliet and I have is we get to work across every sport platform you can shake a stick at. You know, I mean, it's really cool, you know, to work with, you know, elite level athletes in one sport. Imagine that's 50 sports. Imagine it's every kind of professional sport you can shake a stick at, every national team, every Olympic team. What that means is that we get a lot of data and we get exposed to the minds of all the other brilliant coaches trying to solve the problems of human performance. And we also get to work with a lot of different athletes. So we get a really broad and sort of, you know, amazingly diverse picture. And what we've come to realize in that is that we are seeing finally really understanding sport. We love to compete. You know, I was on the national team in slalom. My wife is a rower at Cal and then a world champion. And, you know, we see the highest expression of sport as really our way of sort of expressing peak physical self-actualization. Like, that's really what it's about. We love to compete. We love the lessons. We know that athletes who compete are also happen to be good at business and have good relationships. They're robust. It teaches us skills. But if we don't take the physical lessons that we learn at the highest level of sport and actually transfer them backwards to all aspects of society and to our kids, then sport is just circus. And we might as well just take all the broken athletes and just throw their bodies to the lions when they retire. And just so you're going to ultimately make a pact with the devil. You're like, I'm going to do this, and maybe I'll make some money, and maybe I'll be able to spin this into something, and maybe I'll have this extraordinary life, but I won't have knees, and I'll have three herniated discs, and it will have been worth it for the next 70 years of crippled pain, right? And what we've found, of course, is that A is not the case. That what we're seeing is that, look, contact injuries do happen. It's sport. But our experience, if it's not pathological, if it's not contact, you know, or catastrophic, because sometimes you come down and land on someone's ankle, you can't help that, right? That's going to happen. But most of the injuries we see are 100% preventable. And they're preventable because people don't know what is a good position, what's a stable position, how to maintain it. And so what we're seeing now, you know, spinning backwards, we actually ask 100% of the professional athletes we know, and I'll ask you this, would you let your kids be professional athletes?
No.
Oh, and guess what? We're still at 100%, which is so interesting because in the United States especially, I think we're really enamored with the idea of professionalism in sport. But what comes along with that is actually a really almost monk-like, like, you know, existence where you're battling injury. It's not very glamorous. You don't really get to spend a lot of time traveling. It's really satisfying sometimes. But the downstream is that maybe or maybe not you've been paid millions of dollars. Most likely not. And what ends up happening is that when you retire, you've lost some critical time skills where you literally could have been developing, you know, yourself as a business person or going to med school or something like that. You know, and the other piece around this is that we see that people are retiring with really significant injuries. And in fact, that's usually the driver of their retirement is that, oh, I can't have a shoulder surgery. I've torn my Achilles again, you know, you know, and what we found is that most athletes come to us for two reasons. One is that they're losing, and two is that they're injured and they don't know how to stop being injured. And that's when we see a really window of consciousness. So our idea is, hey, let's spin this up. Let's take our best practices around athletes so we can actually find out what the upper levels of self-actualization are, right? Let's really see how far. If we just took off your fitness, which we're really good at, we can just basically take fitness off the table now for most professional sports. I mean, we're getting there where people are fit enough, right? So we may be able to get you more powerful. You know, are we really going to increase your vertical jump? No, but I can make you so you can jump just as high longer, right? Probably. I can make you more robust. I can change your reaction time by reducing variability in your footstep and how stable your hip is. But the real thing then is, you know, if we can, you know, keep you injury proof and at the highest levels of performance, then it just comes down to who's the best at sport. And that's an interesting conversation to have. Like, who really is the best? You know, whose theory works the best? Whose system works the best? How do we support athletes? How do we take those lessons and then say, hey, look, USA Volleyball at the highest level of Olympics should be the gold standard for how we train children backwards. We're saying that this is Formula One. These are the lessons we've learned in Formula One. And by the way, we're testing it on the best athletes in the world who have environmental loads are insane. You know, suddenly like you're traveling, you're sleeping in a different bed every night, the sleep is terrible, you're injured, you still have to perform because you are a pro, right? But the problem is we take that same paradigm and apply it towards all other sports. And we're not developing athleticism. And so one of the kind of other greater questions we're having now is we're saying, okay, I don't want my kids to become professional athletes. If they want to and are driven and they're balanced and injured and doing these other things, then of course I'll support their dream, of course. But you know, what we're really looking at is how do we take the skills, because volleyball, we have fallen in love with volleyball. Hand-eye coordination, the lateral movement, right? It is the best. I feel like it's the best sport I've ever seen for young people. The amount of contact time they have, the amount of ball time, the sport goes fast. They're actually playing. You know, it's like futsal is to soccer, right?
Yeah.
We get so much contact with futsal that we develop really excellent skills. And so, you know, the self-actualization, I mean, the unconditional positive regard the kids get for making a mistake. You know, a kid makes an error and five girls are like, you got the next one. I mean, that's incredible. Where does that happen? We think that, you know, you've got to have a ball sport in your repertoire as a kid. You probably also need to be exposed to some sort of, you know, sliding sport, you know, like it's important that you surf or skate or ski or something, right? You've got to be able to have that kinesthetic awareness. And you probably need to be doing a little front squatting, at least overhead squatting, some basic mechanics. And on top of that, you need an aerobic base. Like the kids who have an aerobic base their whole lives, their training age is so much more advanced than, like, my gymnasts, for example, extraordinary athletes. We have some national champion gymnasts at our gym, right? Very, very competent athletes, aerobic base, goose egg. And, you know, they're digging themselves out of this hole because, you know, it wasn't part of the package of saying, what does it look like to create people who are stable and want to play for life? And one of the greatest aspects of volleyball is that you can play beach volleyball forever, play pickup with your friends. Like, it is a life skill. You know, my 41st birthday was not so long ago at the beach, and man, we all played volleyball. And what's so cool is that my 9-year-old daughter was mixing up with all the adults and was better, frankly, than most of the adults. Right.
Right.
So, I mean, those are the issues we're looking at, and what we see is, you know, we know that as a coach, it's difficult because you've got to actually practice skills, you got to get kids fit. But what we're seeing, you know, where do you apply? Where do you start working on mechanics? Where do you start, you know, working on tissue health? Well, it's got to fit in on top of the already busy schedule, you know. And the problem is, you know, you're scootering around Italy, you know, and you know, you're exactly what you're like 5'8", 5'7". How tall are you?
6'6".
6'6". So those chairs are designed for someone 5'8", right?
Yeah.
And what ends up happening is we don't know what's a problem until it's a problem.
Yeah.
And so in engineering terms, this is common. And this is how we've done it, you know, that you move well, obviously, because that's usually your genetics are good and you're a good athlete. But you've survived to a point and gotten through the system without being damaged, right? Because it's serious. And the NCAA, like whether we like it or not, is like a Ponzi scheme. It's a $1 trillion business built on the back of amateur athletes who don't have health insurance, who come out with significant injuries, for the chance of getting some of their college offset. And don't get me wrong, I think college sports are brilliant in terms of community and experience, but we're not protecting athletes. You've got to come out unharmed. And if your sport is just trashing you, you're going to have a conversation like, is this third herniated disc when I'm 21 worth it?
Yeah, or concussion, right? Jeez.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Check this out around the concussions. You know, when we think in volleyball, not a lot of concussions, but man, you know, these are big, huge, fast-moving people. And, you know, what we know is that if we see someone, and this is based on the physicians we work with, so we see someone concussed 2 or 3 times, really, just a good concussion, we see that their body down-regulates how much growth hormone they produce. Because you've rattled your anterior pituitary, And so suddenly what ends up happening is you can get away with sort of insulin growth factor going down. Remember that insulin growth factor comes in on the macrophage and repairs all of the micro damage you're doing. What we see is that when people hit their 30s, their tissues start to disintegrate and they start to have more and more cumulative injuries. They get 40 and their body literally falls apart. And it's not because they've been concussed once. It's because they've been concussed like tens of times.
You know? Yeah.
And if you play soccer or football or hockey, you know, like women, I mean, we don't realize, but we've got to look at the whole thing. How do we mitigate the damages or the associated dangers of what we're doing? And a lot of that doesn't start with better mechanics. We can put you into better positions. You know, some of the head stuff, well, we know that tackling a little bit better. We talked to a lot of youth football kids, for example. Kids don't squat often. So when they tackle, their heads are really low. Mm-hmm. When we actually get them front squatting regularly, right? Not just who's stronger, but front squatting, overhead squatting, we are able to create a much more upright torso, and that translates into a much better tackling position where the head isn't coming down. Yeah. Right. So needless to say, we're seeing all of these things, but we're finding them because we're working at the highest levels of sport, and now we're understanding what we're seeing. You know, and so you know, the blocking position of the net is really strong, is armpit forward, you know, so that I am in a stable position. And if I come up and my elbows flare out, then I'm going to get beat at the net, right? Mm. Well, that's the position we're seeing people do push-ups in. That's the position I do a burpee in. Yeah. So what we're seeing is that people are reinforcing these bad mechanics. And then when it matters most, under the highest levels of stress or when I fatigue, I'm going to default to those practice states. And that's where we can immediately start to make huge changes, because if kids come through the system correctly, and it's very simple, right? We start to optimize some of these basic mechanics in kids so they understand what the goal is, then they become very coachable. And they also become very safe and very robust. So at some point we have to say, okay, we're gonna have to start this intervention further and further along. And what I'm really recommending for every pro athlete I know is, I'm like, get involved with your kids' sports, show them what you learn, talk about hydration, talk about warm up. I mean, it's just basic stuff, right? I mean, daughter's first big tournament of the week, you know, of the year, and you know, the girls are sitting around braiding each other's hair, and then boom, we're playing. And
yeah.
I'm like, oh, is that how it goes, right? So I get it. I mean, it's tough.
Yeah. This so you talked about a wealth of stuff there, but a lot of it is needed really for people to understand, because when we're talking about youth in sports and specialization, and also throwing in there, I know we talked a little bit in the pre-talk about how conditioning with teams can be very poor, let's say, in many teams, just the form that they're teaching and the everything about it really. So I like how we're talking specialization or technique, the teaching of technique in sport can be really high level, but teams are overlooking the technique and the form in the training, like the strength training and conditioning of athletes. And so what are some of the ways you think that we can really begin to kind of like chip at that iceberg to change that?
Well, I think, you know, first is that no one steps out with the intention to injure anyone. You know, people are doing, you need to let that dog in, I hear that scratching. You know, what people doing is that, you know, they inherit a system. I'm doing what I know, right? And this is what, you know, has worked for me. You know, there's a girl on our, there's a young coach we were talking to, you know, who is playing at her local university, and, you know, she's come out, she's a freshman. She has two herniated discs, right, as a freshman, right? And because of that and her inability to stabilize or understand what her stable spine construct looks like, right, the systems that make her spine stable, subsequently she also has terrible bladder dysfunction. So she is, you know, pelvic floor dysfunction is a big problem. If we are serious and talking to the professional athletes who are listening, there are a lot of women who pee themselves every single jump. Come down and pee. And, you know, what we're seeing is that that's, again, a symptom of, how do I know I have a problem? Well, I know I have a problem as an athlete when it hurts, which means I'm well into the injury path, right? That's a lagging indicator. That's like waiting for your check engine oil light to go on before you realize you need to add oil. Like, that's ridiculous. Let me potentially injure or damage my car, or wait till the car blows up Because then once you, if you've ever gone down the sports medicine route too, because you know, remember I paddled on the national team and I was paddling until my hand went numb, right? And I became weak and that got my attention, right? I couldn't turn my head without pain. Yeah. And then went down the MRI, cortisone, you know, acupuncture, massage, you know, x-ray, do you have a fracture, chiro. I mean, I was just like, show me what to do so I can go race at team trials because that's the only thing that matters. Like, I'm like, I don't need my hand. I don't even need to be able to feel my hand. I just need to be able to work, right? And it's easy to make those bargains because as an athlete, there's no off button. But, you know, what we know is unequivocally – there were 17, you know, 100 warning signs about my position, my mechanics. But what I did was paddle 300 times a year, 300 days a year, sometimes twice a day. And, you know, I mean, like, of course, I paddled myself into a little hole, lost, you know, my tissues became stiff, my mechanics were terrible. But because I could still do it, I assumed that I was doing it correctly. Yeah. And, you know, and when I asked around, everyone said, hey, you know, is this normal? And they were like, oh, yeah, totally normal. It happens all the time. I was like, you think this is normal? You knew this was going to happen to me? Like, this is my right hand. And when we start going down that path, it's pretty extraordinary. So and every sport has its little, you know, right now we're not seeing lumbar dysfunction in rowing, Olympic rowing like we used to. Instead, we're seeing fractured ribs. Like the number of rib fractures, it's insane. And how do you fracture a rib? Well, your serratus pulls so hard during trying to stabilize the shoulder that you actually fracture your own rib with your musculature, right? Wow. Plus the training volumes are incredible and no one sleeps and right, all the whole thing. Mm. My point is, you know, how do we know we have a problem? Well, usually we see pain, swelling, numbness and tingling, loss of force production, right? That gets our attention. But those are lagging indicators. What we get out of better conditioning is a set of leading indicators. I can spot things in these fundamental movements that I know are reflected in, I'm going to see in sport, but it happens so fast in sport because I'm watching so many other things, it's hard to correct it. In a game, if I see you at the net and you're not jumping and you're not pointing your toes and squeezing your butt, that's not what I'm going to cue you in the game. I can't have you be thinking about your foot position. I need you to be thinking about serving and who you're serving to and what's going on and what's happening, right? The mechanics need to be already stable in there. That gives me a chance to, one, go back to the conditioning where I'm reinforcing the fundamental positions of the sport. This is not sport-specific training. This is spine. This is shoulders. Shoulder is the same for any sport. And that's where we can really start to understand, hey, in volleyball, we figured out a lot. And what you'll see is the best technique actually mimics the physiology of the human. And that coaches, because we're obsessed with going fast and jumping the highest and hitting the hardest, most technique ends up matching perfectly the physiologic expression of how the human being works, right? Mm-hmm. You know, armpit forward in the Olympic lifts puts my shoulder into the same stable position as I'm overhead when I swim or block at the net or a good serve, right?
Yeah.
These mechanics are universal. But if I don't ever ask my athletes to go overhead in training, I may never see it. And in fact, they can get away with it a billion times serving until one day they can't or until their shoulder starts to hurt. And most of us can override any of those problems because when the game's on, you know, it's no problem. You know, so what I'm telling you is I think there's a lot of low hanging fruit and there's a lot of opportunity to make sport better if we give fundamentals, but we have to have everyone start to be on the same page that there's no difference between the performance and the strength conditioning. Or this sport. And what I'm telling you is that I don't have to be an expert in conditioning for volleyball. I need to understand this is this human spine. Jumping and landing mechanics are the same for whatever sport it is. The ready position is the ready position. And if your feet are turned out and your upper back is rounded, what is that position? I mean, now your shoulders don't work very well. You can't run to, you know, you just can't step. Your feet are sideways. You're just watching Serena Williams. Just clean up house and then
I missed it.
That's kind of open, right? Every time she goes to move laterally, her feet are straight, right? So that she can step and move laterally, jump, move forward. You can't run with your feet turned out like ducks. You can't step, right? Mm-hmm. Her opponent is turned out this way, and which means that she's slower to move, cuts her windows down. Serena obviously is a genius, but she's also had some really good coaching. And automatically she'll end up in pursuit and then her feet come back to this race state. So when we tell kids this is what we expect and then reinforcing the conditioning, the whole system starts to go better and better. And as a side effect, we get better, safer positions. And that's what we're after, right?
Yeah.
I like that you mentioned about, for instance, let's take it back to when you're talking about American football, let's say, and tackling, and just how if you can front squat, you have this natural strength now. You've got the form and you've got that strength in your body. You're able to do it. It just naturally is probably going to happen on the field when you're doing it, or it's easier to teach also. And it's funny that you mentioned working backwards from, for instance, like USA Volleyball. Let's take volleyball for an example. But I mentioned to you Gold Medal Squared, and it's a plug for them, but hey, I'm not involved with them. But I do love the fact that they teach from a body mechanics perspective. And when I first came to the national team, I mean, it kind of shocked me that here I am with former medal Olympians, and we're being taught volleyball like a nine-year-old. I mean, here's the key for, you know, the five keys for attacking, for serving. Everything, and they broke it down so much. But one of the biggest things that I noticed was this foot out position, this toe out position. They're just like, no, straight forward, be able to move laterally. And when this started clicking in my head and I started doing it, I'm like, this is so much easier, you know. So I do think that that is one way, one huge way. And thanks for sharing a lot of those things, especially about the leading indicators where people need to be paying attention to these things, because us as athletes, yes, we have this tendency, especially in competition, to just say, whatever, it's happening, something weird is happening, I'm just going to push through, go to the end. But the problem is not so much that, because yeah, you're in competition, that is a little bit of a problem. But after, when we don't just say, okay, this was happening, let me backtrack, let me figure this out. So a lot of people need to self-assess, or coaches out there need to be looking for these things, these indicators, so that they can help athletes before.
Well, I think you nailed it. You know, look, I'm a big boy. You know, you're a professional or playing college. You know, there's a time where you're like, hey, this is why I'm doing this, and I may not be the safest, or I may be playing through injury. That's our deal. But the problem is we take that mindset through everything that we're doing instead of really trying to understand. You know, we work with a lot of universities. Some universities are doing it brilliantly. Stanford, pretty good volleyball program. You know, the strength conditioning coach, right. Head of strength conditioning, they're all right. You know, Shannon Turley is sort of head of performance there and really head of football, but it feeds into everything. Mm-hmm. One of the most super brilliant and understands that mechanics and movement, you know, and teaching that is a place for athletes to get better. So one of the things that we've seen in the last, you know, 15 years is that, you know, everyone's like, hey, I need to get stronger and faster. Like, great. So how much stronger do you need to get? How much do you need to squat to play volleyball? 500, 600, 700? Mm-hmm. I mean, like, what number, you know? And we get some of these little languages where Pavel Sotkin, great coach, right, brilliant coach, is like, you know, once you're at 2 times body weight back squat, you're probably strong enough to play any sport. After that, you know, I'm like, well, if you think about that, well, you're 200, you're 220, you're squat 400, like, stop, and let's refine positions. Mm-hmm. What we see is, you know, challenging, you know the question, I guess, is how strong do I need to be? I need to be efficient. I need to have full access to my available power. You know, there's a coach over at Cal, you know, he said to his guys, he's like, look, you can just full snatch 100 kilos, I guarantee you can play in the NFL. You're strong enough to play in the NFL because you are using all of that position instead of, hey, let's just put another 100 pounds on the bar, right? Yeah. Because if you're just super strong, nothing can happen to you. Mm-hmm. You can feel okay. So where is that line? And it's not. And so what we really look at is what is the available. I want you using 100% of your available mechanics. And it turns out you probably don't need to be as strong as you think. You need to be far more efficient than you think. Yeah. And so suddenly now you start to slip in, well, that, you know, overhead squat the Greg Cook was using the functional movement screen, that's a great tool, but how much can you overhead squat? You know, we want our athletes to at least overhead squat their body weight. What do you mean you can't do that? I mean, that's a basic, you know, metric of having to keep the, you know how to have, you know, full range of motion of the ankles, full range of motion of the hips, be able to express the torsion through the hip that makes my torso upright, and simultaneously be stable in the shoulder in that overhead position. And what we're seeing is that people don't even have basic confidence or, you know, competency in that. They do things that look like overhead squatting, i.e. I'm holding a bar over my head and I'm going up and down.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's not overhead squatting. So like what you say, when we teach keys, well, let's take those keys back to the strength and conditioning. And what we're really doing when we use, you know, I'm a CrossFitter, you know, and when I say CrossFit, let me tell you what I mean, means that I use a broad palette of movements that express all the things a human should be able to do. For example, you've got to be able to do a pistol in my world, right? That's a one-legged squat.
Mm-hmm.
And so let's start with, can you squat with your feet together and squat all the way down? Yes or no? And if you can't do that, you do not have normal ankle range of motion and your hips are not normal. I'm not talking about gymnast freakish level, right?
Yeah.
I'm a 235-pound, 41-year-old man, you know, training for the world championships in Outrigger, but I guarantee you I can squat all the way down with my feet together, right?
Yeah.
And that pistol is the full expression of ankle range of motion and hip function, right? And all I'm seeing is I can quickly, as a coach or as an adult or a teacher or as a, you and I are training together and be like, bro, let's work on your ankles. How do I know? Well, you can't get into this shape. So what we're doing then is in the CrossFit land is using a broad palette of movements. You know, in mobility WOD, I've gone even further into saying, here are the things that a shoulder should be able to do, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we sort of have, we call it archetypes, or they're basically what I think is like first principles. They're basic end range shapes that make every other single shape we're doing. And if you, you know, what I can say is, do you have this basic capacity to be in these positions? Good. Now I'm going to challenge that with maybe a little bit of load.
Mm-hmm.
Or let me challenge out a little bit of speed. Oh, you think you can hip hinge? Let's swing a kettlebell and find out, right? Oh, we're not going to swing it once. We're going to swing it 20 times. Oh, that's metabolic demand. And I noticed that at the end, your knees start to come in and you start to overextend your back. Boom, stop. You've challenged your position, and now you need to understand you're breathing hard. Well, that starts to feel like sport again, doesn't it? What happens if I have you run around, do some gassers, right,
mm-hmm.
and then get into your ready position? What happens? Well, you're going to see that people are going to start looking really bad, feet out, knees in, upper back mm-hmm. rounded, because that cardiorespiratory conditioning, we feel like, is one of the biggest limiters to sports performance. People start to get a little tired, the conditioning comes down, and the mechanics flag. Well, one of the things that I'm challenging in my strength conditioning practice is robustness of position. And I have speed and metabolic demand and load and cardiorespiratory demand. It's not just about getting stronger always. Show me you can come back in, right, and overhead squat a PVC pipe after a little bit of running. And what you're going to see is you default to all the crappy shapes that are going to see at the net. So I can use that as a device to say, well, is this a mechanical problem or a motor control problem?
Mm-hmm.
And what we can take off the table is motor control so that it can be a complete conversation from my children coming up into sport. My daughters know how to overhead squat, right? So I know that that's not a motor control problem. Another million reps. By the time they're 11, they're going to be great at it. Practice, mm-hmm. practice, practice. Then it just comes down to, well, maybe they're not strong enough, or, you know what I mean? I start to say, well, why are they breaking down position? But a lot of the issues that we're seeing is you don't have fundamental mechanics. You can jump and run and sprint and work like the man, and then you did a little sitting and you got knee pain. Boom.
Mm-hmm.
And that stiffness didn't start to show up until you got knee pain. That was the first time you learned that your quads were tight.
Yeah.
And that, by the way, is called theater sign. It's an old diagnosis from the turn of the century. People used to go to the theater.
Yeah.
And knees would ache. And one of the things that's happening is that in that sitting,
yeah.
because your rectus femoris is holding your pelvis up, it pulls on your kneecaps, and you stand up and try to go out of that, right?
Yeah.
So we start to be able to say, okay, well, I can improve mechanics. I can do diagnosis myself as a coach. I don't have to have right? Because you don't have to have a degree in exercise science to teach a good push-up. You need to know what good push-ups do and why they're important. So, for example, you know, my daughter was being called out at practice because she was going all the way down to the ground doing a push-up, which is, by the way, a definition of a push-up. It's full range of motion to go all the way down, right?
Yeah.
Like, they literally like, no, Georgia, you got to throw your elbows out, right? Get into this impinged position, right? And then – And guess what? All the kids are sagged. Everyone's into the rotator. They're like, look up. And I'm like, what are you trying to teach my kids? So I told Georgia, hey, look, you keep doing the push-up. And she's like, I get singled out. She was starting to have stress about it. And I was like, no problem, I'll talk to the coach. And those coaches could not perform one push-up, not one, wow, unless they internally rotated their shoulders, overextended, and then locked into a mechanically crappy position. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem, is that we're not seeing. I'm like, do you want my daughters to be able to serve and block and do all the things perfectly? Well, what do you think the hand-together position is in volleyball? It's me creating stability in the shoulder. No wonder Kerry Walsh starts, like you said, the gold square, you know, hands up. What that does when you do hands up, not only, of course, it makes it easy to get your hands together, but your shoulders are stable. Mm-hmm. And I've taken that away. And so what you're seeing is coaches have figured out how to make stable shoulders for the sport. If I get athletes ready to go like this, they can move quickly and have a stable shoulder and get less movement variability. But now how do I reinforce that pattern in the conditioning so kids are drawing connections? Oh, I'm not just doing push-ups. I'm practicing my stable shoulder position so that when I receive, right?
Yeah.
Now we're starting to have a conversation.
I love that. That's so much. I mean, people can take away from that. And I'm not even going to try and dive into all of it, but a lot of people are going to have to push the 15-second back button a lot there. The show notes is definitely going to have a wealth of that. But one thing that you did touch on in the beginning, because I don't want to keep you super long, but there's two things that I want to hit. One that you mentioned, and then another that I really like that I found digging through all your stuff on MobilityWatt, which is a fantastic site for everybody. If you haven't been to it, you got to go check out MobilityWatt, and I will link that up in the show notes. And anybody in the San Fran area has definitely got to come check out your gym. I know I'm going to when I'm up there with San Francisco CrossFit. It's both you and Juliet own that, right?
We are. We're the owners.
Awesome.
And, you got it.
So here's what I want to touch on first. You mentioned about athletes using what they're learning in their sports and this life as an athlete towards life itself. And this is something that, I mean, when you said it, Kelly, like it just blew my mind because I actually started a project called Elite Sports Students. And this project, Beyond Athletic, is part of the mentoring section of that complete project, which is supposed to be mentoring, tutoring, not just for school, but we're talking about life tutoring, and then showcasing academically, athletically, everything for anyone involved. And what I see so often is that athletes, they're just lost. They're lost while they're in sport. They're lost after they're out of sport. I mean, think about if they don't stop because of injury, first of all, that's psychologically challenging because now you stop something you were passionate about, or maybe I hope you were, unless you were forced to do it.
You've done maybe for like the last
10 years. Now you're lost. You don't know what to do. You could become clinically depressed or easily just, let's just say it, depressed. And
you know how many, I have so many Olympic gold medalists who come home with the biscuit.
What do I do?
Fall apart.
What do I do?
You know what I'll do? I'll go from back to another Olympic.
Yeah. See, and this is the kind of cycle we get thrown into as athletes. And the problem is that people just aren't looking. I mean, it goes back to what you talk about with mobility, which I love, is like you feel pain somewhere, but that's not where it's coming from. It's coming from somewhere else. You got to be able to diagnose where it's coming from. In sport, you might be doing something, you might get an overuse injury. Where is that coming from? In life, you know, you might get injured some way, like whether it's emotionally, physically, psychologically, and you've got to look at the bigger picture here. And so I encourage anybody that's listening, go to beyondathletic.com/ESS if you're a young athlete and sign up there, because what you're going to get are tools, being able to hear people like Kelly here, who's at the top of the game in mobility and strength and conditioning and also nutrition. I mean, I loved your hydration piece with Stacy Sims. I'm actually going to have her on too now because of that. She's rad. And
she's
so rad. And get people like this in your life. Get mentors, like he was saying, athletes out there listening. Give back. Teach these kids what you've learned over your career. Don't let them make the same mistakes. I mean, I didn't even know I could play volleyball in high school, Kelly. I didn't know I could do it in college. I didn't know I could play pro. I didn't know I could get to the national team. Every step of the way I had to learn, and I had to force my way into all of them. And I love that I did because I learned so much. Now I can give it back. So, and the last thing that I want to talk about that you were, or that we didn't touch, and there's so much that we could talk about, dude, but Rice versus MSE or MCE, Like the methods of recovering from injury, I just see it time and time again that so many people are doing it wrong. And it opened my eyes when you had that up and I started reading about it. It was funny because when I was in Indonesia, talk about somewhere where they have no idea what's going on. The compression part, I know this is for sure, and I know rest is for sure, but I've never been able to be injured and just stop moving. I've always felt worse, and like my ankle injuries to this day, you talked about squatting with your feet together. No, not happening, dude. Hips, ankles, everything, no. So why do you say that MCE is the new formula for basically recovering from injury?
Well, what we know, you know, if we go back even, the doctor who coined the term RICE, rest, ice, compression, elevation, is Dr. Gabe Merkin. He's a friend of ours. He wrote the original sports medicine textbook, you know, and literally brilliant, brilliant, brilliant physician. And he was like, hey, we got it wrong. Last year he came out and said, we were wrong. We didn't have a complete understanding of the physiology. We had our best understanding at the time, and now we know a little bit more. And what we saw was, and we've come to understand, one is that icing an injury, there is not a single piece of research that shows icing helps an injury. Like, so that's completely, there's no research in the field, in the literature, that shows that that works. Second is that we see that when you ice something, basically what you do is you shut down the prostaglandin release. So after an injury, one of the swelling parts, that inflammation, is vital because it's one of the ways that it signals that your body, the rest of your body, you're injured. You don't have all the stem cells on site. You need additional floating stem cells in your body to come in and heal that at site. And if you cut that connection between the stem cell, the injury site, and all the circulating tissues, they basically float on past. All the macrophages that come in and eat all the old tissue, right, the garbage dump, the insulin growth factors that come in to signal the healing and protein synthesis, all those things, those connections are cut with icing. So we know is that we just downregulate the amount of healing that can happen. The other problem with icing is that you actually recongest an area. Because what we told people is like, hey, the swelling is a problem. We know that's causing your pain, so let's manage the swelling. What we're trying to do is manage swelling with icing instead of evacuating the swelling. And so what we absolutely need to do, and the reason we know compression works, is that by squeezing that area, we make it difficult for the area to actually be able to swell. And theoretically, we're pumping the area, because the lymphatic system is the sort of passive system where all of the swelling sort of fluids go into your lymphatic system, and then your muscle contraction pumps that lymphatic system out. So rest means what? Well, I'm not moving the area, and that means that those tissues are congesting. I don't have any other mechanism for decongesting because I'm not getting muscle contraction, I can't drive and out and dump the lymphatics. And because, remember, it's a closed system, garbage out also pulls groceries in. And if the garbage gets stuck, then what ends up happening is your body's like, hey, this is a problem. You've got broken cells in there. It comes and starts a secondary inflammatory response.
Yeah.
So what we found is that, boy, we have better, you know, active recovery is always best. And that means pain-free movement or putting on a mechanical dumping device like the Mark Pro allows me to have non-fatiguing muscle contraction, which without moving the joints, I can move kind of pain-free, plus compression, plus elevation, and bam, we are getting people back so much faster without compensation, without torn. I mean, think how many times you sprained your ankle and think how many times your ankle went into an ice bucket and literally you were shutting down all the healing. And what we start to see is, of course, primary instability, and incomplete healing, and that leads the ankle to more susceptible. And then we're like, well, let's brace the ankle. And then it's just this downward.
Yeah, it's terrible.
It's a problem. So what we found, and remember, I'm a physical therapist, and it means I have a clinical practice. And you know, we're basically, with the techniques and tools that we have now, people are out of surgery. We are getting them pumping early on with some of these devices, plus wearing compression socks, plus elevating, and we're ahead of swelling in 12 hours.
Wow.
If you know something, if you know it's going to snow, this is my friend Gary Reinhold, who wrote the book Ice. You know, the if you know it's going to snow an inch an hour for the next 24 hours, you can go out every hour and just sweep off the snow, right? No big deal. With a broom, just blow it off. But if I wait until I have 2 feet of snow, and here in California it's never going to snow, so that's not a problem, but if I wait till I have 2 feet of snow, I'm not going to be able to go out with a broom. And what we've done for athletes is we're like, oh, you injured it, stop moving, the ankle is this big, and now we have a real problem getting down. So if we get early compression on, I get athletes back into the field, you know, like literally bad ankle sprain, looks like a grapefruit, play tomorrow. It's pretty
remarkable. Yeah, and I can attest to that myself, because literally in Indonesia, I sprained my ankle, of course, somebody coming on under the net. And while I don't like these ankle braces, I can't remember what they're even called, the ones with the hard material, I don't like them because I wore them for a while and my ankles got weaker. And what I do wear, though, are these ones that kind of wrap around. And I like them better because too often, especially when you play, people that just don't know what they're doing, they come under the net. And I don't care how strong your ankles are, somebody steps under you and you're coming down from wherever, you have a good chance.
Giving some proprioception to something makes total sense. It's interesting that, you know, we get a lot of compression and proprioception around the knee with the knee pad automatically.
Yeah.
Like, it's interesting that we kind of don't look at that, what we're getting out of that. And giving yourself increased warmth and proprioception is crucial, you know. And, you know, what I would say is anything we brace is going to become weaker. Here's an example. We took this idea of belting. Oh, let's belt your back to protect you in a peak load. And we started applying it to the industrial complex, right? With people working in industry. What we found is that people who were belted all the time, their back injuries went through the roof, because if the belt is using as your abs, right, as your trunk musculature, you don't have to learn how to stabilize yourself. And so subsequently, you become weaker and weaker. And so we see the same thing with arch supports. We see the same thing with ankle braces. We need you to work. Putting on a brace while you play, or a wrap that gives you some sort of compression and proprioceptive input so that you can play at the highest levels, is like having your ankles wrapped in football with a vet wrap. It just gives you some, you know, some additional love.
Mm-hmm.
If you're always wearing them, we have a problem.
This is a huge problem.
Right? Yeah. Okay, I'm going to put this on while I'm playing because people are coming to the net. But during practice, I don't do that. And during conditioning, I don't do that.
Yeah, so for
that,
sure.
Now start this up. I mean, this is, you know, in our new book, you know, about trying to clean up the running mechanics.
Ready to run.
We use the same example where we're saying, like, hey, look, let's have you, I don't mind having a little differential in the shoot or the sport, but the rest of the time I need you flat. Why? Because you're designed to have your heel flat on the ground. And if you're systematically shortening your heel cord all the time, well, you need that in sport. So I'd rather give you some error when you're running conditioning and then go flat the rest of the time. You can make the same case around the ankle. So some people are like, oh, okay, I get that a little bit, you know?
Yeah.
I'd like you to be able to play in flat shoes. Court shoes are flat. Adidas Samba, indoor soccer shoes, flat as could be, volleyball shoes, massive heel. What are we doing? Why is that going on? You know?
Yeah. Oh, my volleyball shoes are horrible, man. Horrible.
So there we go.
All right. So listen, that was a ton of stuff. And I like that you just brought up ready to run, because I definitely wanted to hit up that. But before I do, Becoming a Supple Leopard has got to be like one of the coolest books ever for people out there that don't understand all of the things that we were talking about. If you hadn't thought of them before, go check out Becoming a Supple Leopard. I mean, not only was it a Wall Street and New York Times bestselling, blah, 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 that's great. I'm sure you're happy about that. But man, being an athlete and just reading that stuff and knowing I resonate 100% with this, that means more to me than anything. And so I've got to go pick up Ready to Run. I've already told the runners in my life, like, go check it out. I don't even need to yet. I know it's going to have great stuff. But let's wrap up here. I don't want to keep you much longer. And there's a ton of stuff I couldn't ask you. But I do want to ask you, what is your definition of an athlete?
Well, it's funny you mention that. This is actually something that we spend a lot of time thinking about. And, you know, one of the, you know, what we're looking at is sort of general physical competency. One of my favorite definitions of athlete is who picks up the new skill the fastest. Like, this is currently the thing I'm most obsessed with, because, you know, what we're looking for is athletes who can be coached and apply the set of skills over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of data right now coming out of kids who play multiple sports do better, have fewer injury rates, actually have better recruiting, success in college. You know, there's a great study we just tweeted, where Pete Carroll came and said, hey, he'll all, like 70 or 80% of the recruits he had played three sports in high school, and then only 10% or 15%, whatever it was, played one sport. They only specialized in sport. What we're seeing is the non-specialization teaches a more diverse, besides just the overuse injury stuff, teaches us a more diverse movement vocabulary that we're hoping our athletes are able to stitch together, right?
Yeah.
Because how I block at the net should also theoretically matter how I swim, right? Or mm-hmm. good swim position makes me more stable. And so you start to see that, boy, one of my friends, for example, who's now a powerlifter, was a catcher playing baseball, but because he could throw from his knees, he also was really good at water polo. And people are like, it's amazing, you're good at this. And he's like, well, not really. This is what I do,
Yeah.
So what I think for us, the definition of athlete is that you understand how this thing works, that you understand that you have to perform basic maintenance on it. You have the whole picture of, boy, kids between 7th grade and 12th grade, if they get less than 8 hours of sleep, they have almost a 2 times more likelihood of being injured. That's just the sleep piece. So talk to my daughters, and they are squared away about sleep, and they know how to eat. And, what we're seeing is the definition of an athlete at the highest level. For me, the most important thing is who can pick up the new skill the fastest. That's the thing I love. What we see in CrossFit, unfortunately, is that some of the best athletes in our gym are just okay at strength and conditioning.
Yeah.
Right? And it's important that you see the difference there, that being really good in the gym doesn't translate. Learning excellent skills in the gym makes it so that you have this sort of very capable platform that allows you to continue to enjoy the magnificence that is your physical body. And that's what we're looking for.
Wonderful.
Well, thank you so much for coming on. Thanks so much for all the information. I hope I get to pick your brain in person sometime. Hopefully come to cheer on G-Star. Like, that'd be rad. But I just want to acknowledge you for being somebody who thinks outside the box, really, because we need it. We need it in sport. We need it in life. And I want to say thank you for taking your time to do this and for continuing to push those limits out there, because without people like that, we won't get anywhere. So
that's very kind. And, one of the coolest things is, all the best coaches in the world I know are very transparent. Like when you have Stacey Sims on, for example, you're going to understand that she'll tell you how it all works. She's not keeping her little secret ninja
stash.
Yes. There's no secret squirrel program.
Yeah.
All the best coaches in the world are the most generous people I've ever met. You can go to the World Athletic Center and train with Coach Dan Pfaff. And you can have that experience. You can go and have access to the best coaches on the planet and see their writing. For the first time ever, I think we've all come and are realizing what best practice starts to look like. And if we don't fix it in this generation of athletes and really see a tide change, shame on us. Because what we've seen is you're a product of the system. You're an Olympian. You've had this experience. You're like, this is amazing. What does this all mean? And how do I make it make sense backwards? That's where we're going to really move the boat, we'll move the ball forward, for lack of a better concept.
So yeah.
Very kind, but the number of athletes and coaches I get access to, this is all part of the bigger system.
Yeah, and giving back really is what we should be doing. I mean, paying it forward. So I love that. Listen, how can people connect with you? What's the best way?
Well, our site is called Mobility Wad. And that's WOD, it's workout of the day. What we're trying to give people is the consciousness that this is a daily practice, especially if you're an athlete. You got to do it. You got to have a basic understanding of how you work. We're on Twitter at MobilityWad. We've got some other fun projects going on. I got to put this on people's radar because we're about to launch. It's called StandUpKids.org.
StandUpKids.org.
And what we've done is we think that getting kids out of these sedentary positions of the chair in elementary school, middle school.
I love this.
Everything. We have flipped 100 desks at our daughter's school so far. My first graders in the first standing classroom, first grade, we think in the nation. We'll have the whole school at standing desks by this summer. It'll be the first standing school in the world. And what's happening is that this is childhood obesity. Kids who stand burn between 25 and 35% more calories a day. This is taking a crack at ADHD. This is, you know, like go down the list. Orthopedic dysfunction. Wanting kids not to be all saggy and round and bent. Well, get them standing. We just, you know, the whole thing works. We're getting to the place now. And again, this is our lesson. Where we were doing this at the highest levels of sport and in business, we just took the ideas and went them backwards. And this is the thing we're most proud of right now. We're starting to see this as a public health issue. We're taking the lessons we're learning through sport, and we are affecting the health of the people in that world, especially.
And that's exactly why I said in life and in sport. So thanks for being on the show, and we'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thanks, man.
Did you like the show? Leave a rating and review on iTunes or Stitcher.com so others will find us, and share the love. Think of one person that could benefit and send them the link for this episode. For more resources and tips, go to beyondathletic.com or tweet us at beyondathletic. I appreciate and thank you for listening.
What we do in life echoes in eternity.
I'm going to show you how great I am.
And this concludes our Chicago show. Please stay tuned.